Hi, I'm Ken Kessler, and welcome to the Sounds of Christmas podcast. If you're new to this podcast, I want to start by saying thanks for joining us. If you're not new, welcome back. Either way, I'm glad you're here. Now, to avoid any confusion, I want to start off by saying there won't be any music played here. This is a place for conversation. I'll talk about Christmas music and some related topics, sometimes by myself and sometimes with guests. If you're looking for music, just go to soundsofchristmas.com and click on the tree or the player on the front page or on the Listen Now page. We play the best variety of Christmas music all year long. Well, except in October, when we play the best variety of Halloween music. This is the fifth and probably final episode in our Christmas Podcast Palooza series for Christmas in July, where I've invited other hosts of Christmas-themed podcasts on to talk about their podcasts and hopefully share some Christmas spirit. I say probably because several people who wanted to be on couldn't make it because of either illness or scheduling or a myriad of other problems. So there's a good chance that one or two more of these may pop up in August. That said, today I'm happy to be joined by Robert from the Behind the Bells podcast. Hi, Robert. Thanks for joining us today.
Merry Sunday.
How long have you been hosting Behind the Bells?
Well, I've been hosting Behind the Bells and producing it as well since the November of 2020 when I debuted my first two-part episodes of Disney's The Santa Claus, going to that whole deep dive.
What led you or drove you to start doing this podcast?
I happen to not just love movies, but I love the stories that go behind the making of those movies, really finding out about the people who go far as back as just coming up with the initial idea. As myself, I've worked in the industry for a good 15 years myself, doing a variety of different jobs from acting, writing, and even just miscellaneous background work. And of course, I also went to school at UC Irvine, where I studied film studies. And thus, I've always been one of those kinds of guys that had loved to analyze and just really deep dive into any movie's themes, symbols, just to really get all the underlying context of what was going on within that story. Now, how exactly I got around to doing Christmas movies is fascinating, because when it came to doing a podcast, I had always wanted to do some kind of film podcast. But let's face it, there's hundreds, thousands, maybe even millions of different kind of movie podcasts. So that's when I decided to start narrowing it down to specific niches that I liked. And I guess I could have covered another comic book set of podcasts, where I could have covered superhero films, which I love as well, but there's tons of those as well. But it wasn't until I suddenly started asking myself, what was the kind of movies that I really get passionate about? And it just happens to be Christmas films, holiday films of most kinds. And that's when I suddenly realized that there really wasn't even that many people that really did their whole job of just analyzing and going into the whole, like, behind the scenes makings of Christmas films. So me being already a fan of other big movie based podcasts, like You Must Remember This, which is another really good one that also does deep dives, but they tend to focus on actors and not the movies themselves. So I decided to separate myself by really focusing on specific movies in that matter. And when it came time to actually started doing my show, I decided to go with The Santa Claus, because I know that happens to be a very beloved Christmas movie for a lot of people. And then, of course, once I started looking into that one, that also really got me to start looking around to realize that every great movie has a good story, just as long as it's told in the right context. And thus, once I really had my full setup on how I would do my two-parters with The Santa Claus, I decided that would essentially be my format for almost all my episodes, with the exception of my editorial episodes, which would focus on either like smaller Christmas TV specials or maybe Christmas movies that don't have as much of a story to tell, but are just still something I want to talk about. Like currently how I'm doing all my mini episodes on Nickelodeon cartoon specials, as that was what I grew up on in the 90s and the early 2000s. But since the Santa Claus, that is exactly how I've really wanted to stick with that format with my show.
Since you do delve into some of the stuff that's been on TV, do you have any plans, and this may be hard to answer, to take a look at the Santa Claus miniseries that's going to be coming to Disney Plus this fall?
Oh, absolutely. At some point, I probably will get around to that. But, well, because I, well, this is my hopeful thinking, that I would hope my show gets to go on for many, many years. That I guess if I do eventually cover that, it's probably not going to be for a little while, because I do want to allow some time between something coming out before I eventually start covering it. Because when it comes to a lot of the behind-the-scenes stuff that gets put out as something is being released, that is all studio-mandated and all the material that wants to be released. But usually a lot of the more like incredible deep dive stuff doesn't really emerge for several more years once the actors and anybody working on that project have been given some kind of legal clearance to get the go-ahead to discuss that sort of thing. And with the miniseries, of course, I'd love to cover that. But, of course, I do need to cover the other sequels as well, the Santa Claus 2 and Santa Claus 3, The Escape Clause, which themselves have some pretty fascinating stories behind that. But that's going to be a little further down the road, as I still have a lot of other classics to cover, especially knowing that I've only covered one Rankin-Bass special, and that was the original Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
What a wonderful classic that one is. That's a good one to start with. Have there been any deep dives that you've done on holiday movies where you came across something that really surprised you, that you couldn't believe people didn't know?
Okay, well, it's kind of funny you mention that, because when it came to the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer special, my first episode really dwells into the actual behind the scenes on how the original classic story was made, and then how the song was made as well. And I actually had no idea that the original story itself was initially written specifically as a marketing thing for the Montgomery Ward department stores just a little bit before World War II had started. But that's not to say it was all just one giant corporate thing. I mean, it was still a story that came from a place of passion from its original writer, who had been inspired by a lot of other elements, especially just from the purpose of wanting to write a Christmas story for his child, and wanting to focus on a reindeer on that aspect, because he really wanted to focus it on a specific Christmas animal. And yeah, we do know the classic seven reindeer, but before then, there really had not been any kind of attempt to add another name to that whole roster of the classic reindeer. And of course, even when that whole story based being written, I was totally surprised by the songwriter, who, on the one hand, had fought in World War II and thus was a real hero who had really gone after and defeated a whole bunch of Nazis. This is even before he got into his whole songwriting career. And of course, once he did get down and when he wrote that song, all because he was very lucky enough to be family with the original songwriter, he got immediate permission to write the song. And even then, I just found it interesting that he still had a hard time finding an artist that would even want to sing the song. And of course, once Gene Autry got to be the lucky guy to sing it, the song was such a hit that I also thought it was fascinating to learn that it became the very first number one song of the 1950s, because the song was just that popular even after the holidays.
Yeah.
And even connecting those dots, the only reason the Rankin-Bass people got lucky enough to make that special was because Arthur Rankin was neighbors with the original songwriter. So
wow,
it's just this crazy, the stars aligned in the right place just to get that special made. And that itself just surprised me more than anything. That, I mean, if that wasn't destiny, I don't know what is.
Yeah, that's amazing. I had no idea they were neighbors. And a lot of people didn't know Johnny Marks is the guy that you're talking about, and that he's responsible for so many other Christmas songs since Rudolph. Rocking Around the Christmas Tree, I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day, Silver and Gold. I think he was involved with several of the Rankin Bass shows. He, because of Rudolph, he finally did get credits on Chuck Berry's Run, Rudolph, Run. He has a long roster of songs that we all know and love, but Rudolph is head and shoulders above everything. It's just, it's Rudolph. I mean,
exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's just it's crazy to know too, that because he wrote all those Christmas songs, this guy just created this whole Christmas song empire, with his own publishing company. Cause the guy, but thankfully, Johnny Marks, had already made a good living songwriting and even, working with other artists beforehand. And it just so happened that he managed to get into this whole business that he would really come to love, because you could tell that all those songs came from a place of passion.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's hard to imagine that the same guy who came up with Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer also came up with I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day. Two very different songs, but it's the same guy. It's amazing. Has there been any episode or episodes that you think of as your favorite that just are a little above the others for you?
It's funny because I have two different answers, but for two different reasons. I mean, if I had to land on an episode that I was, you know, the most excited to write about, it was probably the one on what has to be my favorite Christmas movie, Home Alone. Because at that point, I also wasn't aware of just some of the trouble that had gone through on set. And I wasn't aware of a lot of the trouble that happened on that set, including the fact that along with actor Daniel Stern actually being let go, the movie was even shut down by its original studio that was handling the production of it, Warner Brothers, up until the Tim Roth, who was the major studio head over at Fox, came in and said, "Hey, I like this. We'll make it for you guys, and we'll give you the budget necessary to make the movie the way you wanted it." And so because of that, there was a whole process of someone going to the set of Home Alone, going door to door to first tell everybody, "Sorry, folks, this movie's being shut down." And then only about 5 minutes later, another guy coming in behind them saying, "Oh, good news, folks. We're back on production. Here's your brand new t-shirts to reflect that." And I mean, it was kind of a crazy mess because nobody really saw Home Alone as anything more than kind of a small Christmas movie that was opening up against Rocky V. And of course, at the time, they thought Rocky was going to beat out Home Alone, but
sure,
surprise, surprise, Home Alone ended up being such a monster hit that it just didn't even leave theaters until June of 1991.
Wow.
Back when they used to have those longer runs. And it was just that thing that I thought, I mean, I wish people really need to know about this stuff. And of course, the other favorite episode I was going to bring up, which seems like another weird one, was when I did my two-parter on Ernest Saves Christmas, which, yes, I know is not that well regarded by a lot of people. And not to mention, even I can admit that the movie is not perfect, but it is a nostalgic guilty pleasure of mine. And plus, that too has kind of a fascinating story, because for those that that obviously weren't old enough to remember, Ernest P. Worrell was a character actor or a character played by Jim Varney, who took this character that was created all as a marketing tool. And he just got so popular doing his own commercials that he eventually got his own series of movies, including Ernest Saves Christmas, which itself was also a lot of firsts, including being one of the first movies to be shot at the Disney MGM Studios in Orlando, Florida, back when they were trying to open up their own set of sound stages down in Orlando. And wow, just the trouble that went through when a whole union strike had happened at the same time, which prevented them from getting a lot of the shots that they needed around Orlando, thus forcing most of the shoot to stay within Disney property.
I grew up in Raleigh, North Carolina, and I remember Jim Varney doing his Ernest character on a series of commercials for Pine State Milk. and it was hilarious. And the reaction of local people when Ernest was going to be in a movie was nothing short of hilarious. Nobody could believe it. And then he did movie after movie as Ernest.
Yeah, in fact, I'm writing this up in my podcast too, but the way he was picked up over at Disney was, it was in the mid-80s when the Indy 500 was going on, and Disney was a big sponsor of that year. And I guess at every Indy 500, they always do this opening parade, just different sponsors and different groups and such. But to put it this way, when the car featuring the governor of then state Indiana, he got a big cheer. The next car came in, and that was Mickey Mouse and Minnie Mouse. It got an even bigger cheer. But then came along Jim Varney as Ernest P. Worrell in his own car afterwards. He got the biggest cheer out of everyone. Everyone was going nuts. And it just so happened that Disney CEO Michael Eisner was in the audience, and he knew he had to take advantage of this situation. So they organized a meeting with the marketing firm that owned the rights to Ernest, and they pretty much got a 5-movie deal right out of there.
Wow. It's amazing. Have there been any topics or I guess movies that you have wanted to cover or feature but just haven't been able to yet?
Okay, yeah. It's funny you mentioned that because one of the next ones that I am covering as my next episode, Miracle on 34th Street, is an area that I am covering. This is the 1947 classic because the fact that it was – well, first of all, it's the one movie where – an actor playing Santa Claus had won the Oscar for acting in that one, Edmund Gwynn's performance. And not to mention, the movie famously got a June release instead of a winter release because the folks at 20th Century Fox were convinced that more people went to the movies during the summer than the winter, which, I mean, there is kind of a truth there. But then again, why put out a Christmas movie during the summertime? They just could not convince them otherwise. And to make it harder, all the marketing material, the trailers, the posters, etc., they could not give away that it was a Christmas movie, even though this is a movie about Santa Claus. So that had to be the single most difficult job for their marketing team that year, to market a Christmas movie without giving away that it was a Christmas movie. And of course, I do want to cover the remake from 1994 with Richard Attenborough and Mara Wilson, which itself has its own history, considering that it was written by Home Alone pen writer John Hughes, and two, unlike the classic, could not use the Macy's brand or imagery or anything, who didn't want to participate for some reason that I kind of have to look into. And even though some people don't like that one as much as the classic, I think that one itself is just as good on its own merits for its own reasons, which I will go into later.
Yeah, I agree with you. When I heard that was coming out, I was kind of disappointed because I thought, why remake this? It's the 1947 movie is a classic and is a near perfect movie. Why do you need to remake it? But after seeing it, I really liked it, and I think there's enough differences that it does stand on its own. Really?
Well, yeah, because there's always a fine line when it comes to picking specific movies to remake. And even when you do, ensuring that there's enough of a difference that that it's its own thing separate from the original in any kind of capacity. I mean, this is kind of why other remakes like the remake of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory by Tim Burton isn't as well regarded. The 2016 Ghostbusters isn't as well regarded, but then they compare it to something like the remake of Dune that happened last year. That itself was just so different from the David Lynch movie that a lot of people really liked that one. And of course, that's what I'm thinking, that of course, when it comes to Christmas remakes, I mean, there aren't too many like remakes of like the classics. Like, we have yet to see one for National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, A Christmas Story, Home Alone. And I mean, even when I think of the classic 40 ones, the only one out of the bunch that I really recall getting a major remake was the TV movie remake of Christmas in Connecticut, the one that Arnold Schwarzenegger directed,
right,
with Chris Christopherson.
Right.
But otherwise, Miracle on 34th Street remakes to me are exactly how to do a remake right.
Yeah, I know that a lot of people were not happy about Disney redoing Home Alone. How was it, just last year? Year before?
Yeah. Which itself is technically a sequel because they do bring back Buzz McAllister in a bit of welcome role, but still, I actually did a whole episode on my podcast of Anthony from Tis the Podcast and two other guys just ranting on that movie for a good hour and a half on what it just didn't get about the original at all, why some of its storytelling options just didn't work for this kind of situation, which is too bad because the film's director has directed several comedies before, including having worked with Sacha Baron Cohen a couple of times. So it's not like he doesn't understand comedy. Because you saw the remake, right?
Yes,
right. And it certainly took a risk by wanting to focus a little more on the burglars this time instead of the kid that's left home alone. The scenario is not going to work if you're still going to play it up like a standard Home Alone movie, because you cannot counterbalance those characters with that amount of time with that kind of story. I mean, even though this is obviously much more of a subjective narrative, it just wasn't that funny in my book. And you know, maybe if it was meant to be more of a kids' film, I'd be much more forgiving of it. But it was clearly trying to throw a lot of jokes for the adults out there, and that's not as easy to really sort of let go, especially when you have one character in the movie that's watching a remake of Angels with Filthy Souls and then complaining, the remakes are never as good. I'm like, oh, don't give me that. Your own movie's not that good.
You know, I think that the recent remake, reboot, sequel, whatever you want to call it, for Home Alone, I think what it's really missing is the heart, the charm that the first one had, because so much of the first one was in Kevin's point of view. This little kid who has never done anything for himself is stuck home alone at Christmas, has to feed himself, has to do the shopping, has to do all that kind of stuff, and is scared at night because he's a kid. And this new one didn't have any of that kind of thing for people to connect with. You could connect with being a little kid and being scared at home. But, you know, the new one, it was mostly about the adults, the burglars, like you said. And it was really hard to care about the characters.
Right. Especially when you also, because I also go over this in that same episode and on my Home Alone episode that, Kevin McAllister himself could be a brat every now and then, but he still acted like a real kid half the time. While the kid in Home Sweet Home Alone, again, he's not a bad actor, because that same kid, who we also saw in Jojo Rabbit, can be directed well in a funny performance. But it was clear that that he was just not given the right direction on how to play a likable bratty kid, and which itself is easier said than done, because let's face it, it's really hard to make any kind of cynical character that likable. And a lot of that really depends on the actor and the way he's directed at the time. And the brilliance of John Hughes' writing was he really knew how not just kids, but just how youth behaved, as we've seen in his other teenage movies. And not to mention, with the way Home Alone was shot in the original, a lot of people usually don't notice this when they see it for the first time, but throughout a good chunk of the movie, a good chunk of Kevin is filmed from a higher filming point, just to make him look much more scared and intimidating. But once we get around to the whole Christmas Eve prank section, Kevin is finally being filmed at the right size to show how much he's grown in these few days within this little coming of age story, just to show that by the time his family has finally come home, he's really learned how to be brave and defend himself.
And the other thing with the original Home Alone is we know very little about the bad guys. Mm-hmm. They're cartoonish villains, and they're greedy and they're just in it for the money, and they have no backstory. We don't know anything about them. But in Home Sweet Home Alone, we know so much about the burglars. It's just the whole thing is completely different. There's nobody to root for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's clearly an attempt at a comedy of errors, since the whole thing rides on the idea of a major misunderstanding, which can be funny, but again, it's not going to work in the case of Home Alone, because there's about a million other ways to solve a lot of their issues or so, even though they do try to justify a few things or so. But again, when you go back to the classic Home Alone, with the way everything is just brilliantly written, everything is set up to not only justify Kevin's actions, but nothing ever feels too over the top in that one. And honestly, the way I see that movie, that was just lightning in a bottle. That was just captured at the exact right time that I doubt is ever going to be captured again. And you could even make the argument that they couldn't even that the original crew couldn't capture that same lightning in Home Alone 2, Lost in New York, even though I do have a soft spot for that movie as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it was different enough that it wasn't quite the same story again.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the parents left him home alone at Christmas again.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was a mix up at the airport and he's in New York. And again, it had the heart and charm of so much of it coming from Kevin's point of view. How cool that he has this great hotel room in the plaza, yeah, and he's ordering up ice cream sundaes and he's going to the biggest toy stores, and you know, it's all things we can relate to, even if we've never done any of those things that we can see ourselves as kids wanting to do. It's something that you can connect with, but I have a soft spot for it too, but it still doesn't capture, like you said, the lightning in the bottle, like the first one.
Yeah, and the way I've always learned is that most great movies are happy accidents where everything just happens to fall in place at just the right time. And that goes for a lot of classic Christmas movies as well, because I also did a whole two-parter on the classic Irving Berlin movie, Holiday Inn, and how a good chunk of the songs that were used in that one had already been written by Irving Berlin and was kind of was him just kind of reusing a bunch of songs he'd already written, but they worked in those songs well enough that movie too would end up such a holiday classic that by the time that the Oscars came around next year, one of the brand new songs for that movie, White Christmas, would end up nominated at the Academy Awards for best song.
Yeah. Are most of the movies, or even all of the movies that you talk about, that you cover, really Christmas movies, as opposed to some of the others that people argue about whether they're Christmas movies, like, of course, Die Hard?
Well, first of all, I do consider Die Hard a Christmas movie, but I totally get why others don't consider it a Christmas movie. And, I mean, the short version of why I do consider it a Christmas film is considering the fact that, one, it is set around Christmas Eve, and a lot of the story does focus on John McClane trying to get closer with his estranged family. And, of course, the holidays is all about connecting with your loved ones. And even though it takes this whole robbery to really put that perspective in his head, knowing that there were just several points in the movie where he thought for sure he was not going to make it, but by the time he does make it to the end and he and his wife are in the limo sharing a passionate kiss before they ride off into the sunset, we feel like that connection that he's earned just in time for Christmas morning has totally been warranted and justified by what has happened that night. And I mean, I definitely do want to cover Die Hard later on to go into that detailing, considering that most people don't even know that whole movie was even based on its own novel called Nothing Lasts Forever, which due to some very funny studio contracts that were going around at the time, before Bruce Willis got the role, they legally had to ask Frank Sinatra if he wanted to play John McClane, even though they knew for sure he'd say no because he was in his 70s at the time.
I remember hearing about that.
But wouldn't that have resulted in a different movie if he actually said yes to that?
Yeah, that would have been amazing. The subject of Die Hard has come up several times on this podcast. And what I always tend to say about it is that I think that it's, as far as I'm concerned, it's a Christmas movie because Christmas is essential to the story. That story wouldn't happen if it was any other time of year. That building wouldn't have been empty or mostly empty except for a Christmas party. None of the things about that story and the plot would have happened if it weren't for Christmas. There are a lot of movies where the story is about something and Christmas is happening also, but they're not really connected. But I don't think with Die Hard you could have one without the other.
That's right. And this is why if I really want to get people debating, that's when I would actually bring up how the original Godfather, the first half of that movie is set around the Christmas season, and yet that whole holiday season has no connection or any bearing on the story at all. You could have cut out the whole Christmas setting and nothing would really be different, because the only seasonal thing that does happen in that story is the wedding of Carla's character, Talia Shire's character. But again, that's just a wedding. That's not the holidays. But most people tend to forget that the first Godfather movie was set around, at least the first half of it, is set around the holidays. And yet I do not count that as a Christmas movie at all.
Yeah, it could have. It's the same argument that I made for Die Hard, that and like you were saying, that wedding could have been any weekend. It didn't. Christmas didn't play a role in it. I was just talking on a recent episode about the movie, the 1990s movie Michael, where John Travolta plays an angel.
Oh, okay.
It takes place at Christmas time, but really it's like Christmas is happening and then there's this story also. They're not connected. Even though he's an angel, it really has nothing whatsoever to do with Christmas. Christmas is only mentioned a couple times at the beginning. And then the entire movie takes place, almost the whole rest of the movie is the next week. So Christmas probably happened at some point during that week, but it's never mentioned. It's never even, for the most part, in other scenes, because there's a bit of traveling that they go through parts of Iowa and a couple other places. And there's no decorations, no anything. So really, It has nothing to do with it. It's just Christmas is happening also, but here's the story. You know, just like with The Godfather, but with Die Hard, it's essential.
Exactly. And because probably I'd say that the least Christmas movie I covered, even though there's still a lot of Christmas in it, was when I did a total two-parter on Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Which was written by the great Shane Black, who had also written another classic that people debate about, Lethal Weapon.
Yes.
So, though obviously a good chunk of his movies, with the exception of the most recent Predator movie, usually are tied around Christmas in some aspect. The Nice Guys itself also had a bit of Christmas in the towards the end, but even that doesn't really count. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang did take advantage of its Christmas in LA situation that still, in my opinion, does make that a Christmas movie.
Are there any movies that you just know are going to require a lot of research, a lot of deep dives to do, that are kind of like on your bucket list to do, but it's something that's just going to take a lot of time and prep to make it happen?
One is certainly a movie I do want to cover that's probably going to be a three-parter, and that's going to be It's a Wonderful Life, because the work that went into that story, Jimmy Stewart's reluctance to do it or even return to Hollywood, the fact that it wasn't a major hit when that came out, and how it took years and years of TV playings and losing its own copyright status that made it a Christmas classic, which itself would obviously take the several episodes. And I know, given that I've already covered one Rankin Bass special, I do want to cover all of the other Rankin Bass specials, which is going to take several episodes until I get to the last one before they ultimately close the Life and Times of Santa Claus adaptation in the 80s. So that itself is going to take some deep diving into, even though I already went into a lot of the technical aspects of stop motion animation in the original Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and how they hired a Japanese studio to handle that responsibility.
It's a Wonderful Life has so much to dig into with.
Exactly.
I mean, I can remember in the 1980s when it was, I don't know if it was technically public domain, but it was basically, it was where you could turn on almost any channel in December, and at some point, It's a Wonderful Life is going to be on, to the point where it was almost a punchline that it was on so often. And now I think it's NBC that has it locked into that you're only going to get to see it on one or two days in December. Mm-hmm. And it's become so much, I think, so much bigger than it ever was. And really, the story is so much just about Jimmy Stewart's character, that Christmas is, you know, a fringe part of the very beginning and the very end.
Yeah, and that's why when on the other podcast, Tis the Podcast, when Tom, Julia, and Anthony were debating whether or not that could be constituted as a Christmas movie, that I could see justified as maybe not being a Christmas story, even though I'd still say that it was ultimately the holidays at the end that rounded him back into exactly where he needed him to be. Even though when you do watch, I'd say the first 70% of the movie, nothing about it, it could be Christmas related. And here's a little fun fact for you. I actually first saw the movie back in high school when we were shown the scene on the bank run, when we were being taught a lesson in economics on how banks actually work, when everybody's running to the bank to try to get the cash and Jimmy's got to tell them, oh, I don't have your money like in a pile in the back there. No, your money's in Kennedy's house. Your money's in Bill's house.
Yeah.
But even then, when you really consider, just the whole like third act, the big climax of life being shown, had it not been the Christmas season, especially towards the end when everybody comes together to essentially gift him and his family that, that's when I debated that had it not been the holidays, would the town have been as generous as they would have been towards the end?
Good question.
And not to mention last season, I even wrote a little fan fiction that retold part of the story of It's a Wonderful Life and the 5 years later story as told from Potter's perspective. Considering that that when it comes to classic Hollywood, he is one of the few famous villains who was never defeated in that movie.
Did you ever see the, speaking of defeating Potter, there was a Saturday Night Live skit where they supposedly found the lost ending where everybody just beats the heck out of Mr. Potter?
I've seen that ending. That actually, when I wrote up my whole little fanfic, somebody brought that up. And of course, I thought that was hilarious. Even on my mind, I felt like that within the 5 year time span, so much would change within American society and so much would have changed within Bedford Falls, especially for Potter, that even had he not been defeated in the movie, the guy was already really old by the time everything on that Christmas Eve took place. And given how the whole point of him stealing the $8,000 was his last attempt to really take out his one competition in town, now that everybody had come together to help pay for Jimmy Stewart's character to stay in business, that would have solidified him, you know, staying on board as competition. And in time, eventually, Mr. Potter's old way of thinking was just not going to be the right answer anymore when it came to running his business there. And thus, in my mind, he probably would have either been put out of business or at least him being forced to retire at a later point, where he probably would have died very lonely because he had nobody that loved him.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard. I mean, we don't see that much about Mr. Potter, so, but it's hard to imagine that there is a Mrs. Potter or a bunch of little Potters running around. He seems like a very Ebenezer Scrooge kind of character in that he's solitary. This is it. And in that case, if that were the case and he were to die, everything would just go to Bedford Falls.
Right. And that was the movie's great lesson, because Jimmy Stewart had helped out so many people, and obviously he made so many friends within all those years. He always had at least one of the person he could rely on, even though his wife, played by Donna Reed, always stuck with him through the best case and worst case, considering how by the time they got married, he'd given away all the savings to everybody in town, and they had their honeymoon in the house that she had hoped that would be the dream house, which was exactly the goal they got to, even though they weren't wealthy at that time. They still had each other, and Jimmy Stewart still had everybody in that town that he could call upon as a friend, while Potter, should his worst case scenario come on, who's he going to call on? Because, you know, if he tries calling on like the other people that were on his board at his bank, they probably would have seen him as an expendable like number that wouldn't matter, because nobody ever talked positively about Mr. Potter in any light other than the guy that owned everything in town. And Jimmy Stewart never came off as that guy. He always came off as the guy that you go to when you're in a bad situation.
Yeah, there was even, I don't remember the character's name or even if he has a name, somebody who worked for Potter. Before Potter offered George Bailey a job, he was showing him all the things Bailey was doing, and then finally said, pointing to himself, that he would probably be looking for a job from George Bailey one of these days.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I actually looked into it for my little my little fan fiction writing, and there was no name given to that guy, so I just called him Jasper.
That fits. So what's coming up? What would you like to tease without spoiling anything? What's coming up on Behind the Bells?
Okay, well, along with an upcoming two-parter on Miracle on 34th Street, I have an upcoming editorial on Miracle on 34th Street that's going to bring on three additional podcasters that I don't want to give away yet, but I'm really excited because these are some classic names within the whole Christmas space. And later on this year, I am going to be covering National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. And not to give away anything, but I'm in the middle of contacting someone from the movie that worked on it and played a vital part that may be coming on my podcast, but let's just leave it there because I don't want to give away who it is just yet.
Okay. What's the best way for people to find Behind the Bells?
Ah, well, you can find Behind the Bells on Apple Podcasts. You can find it on Spotify. You can find it on Amazon Audible. You can find it anywhere on the Anchor things. And, of course, you can even find my show on YouTube where all my episodes are uploaded in case you're not subscribed to any of those podcasting stations.
Nice. Robert, thanks so much for spending a whole bunch of time with us and some Christmas spirit with us today.
Hey, no problem. It was a lot of fun to be on the show. It was really fun to be on today's show with you.
And thank you so much for listening, for continuing to support the Sounds of Christmas Station and podcast. Station is still on, by the way, so anytime you need a little musical Christmas spirit, just head on over to soundsofchristmas.com, click on the tree or the player on the front page or on the Listen Now page, or look for us, look for our app in the Google Play Store. As far as this podcast goes, we're now on over 30 podcasting sites. So if you didn't find us on your favorite today, just search for The Sounds of Christmas wherever you like to listen and consume podcasts, and I'm pretty sure you'll find our tree there. Then you can subscribe, and you'll never miss another episode. If you have comments or suggestions on this episode, previous episodes, the Sounds of Christmas Station, or the upcoming Standard Station, feel free to reach out to me on social media or through the website. Thanks again, and may you always believe in Santa Claus.